Chapter 11. Resonance. When the gravitational hold of the fortress weakened, and the fleet prepared to enter the warp again, Sanguinius called Uncani Cano to the Sanctorum Angelus. Sanguinius looked at the golden sculptures that made the space into an oasis of meditation, unable to draw peace from them.
"Do you know how we won, Empyrean?" Sanguinius asked.
"I do not," Cano confessed.
Sanguinius told the librarian a version of what he had experienced. He was circumspect about the visions.
"I saw visions of defeat," he said. "I found a single one of victory and chose it."
He described the great fall and the cleaving of the knots.
"Then you destroyed the Manufactorum," Cano said, awed.
"And by extension the fortress gate itself, with a single blow. What I saw has given me great hope, but the implications trouble me, too. I must not believe I wield such cataclysmic power. No one should. The idea is corrupt and corrupting."
Cano shook his head.
"The things we are seeing are beyond anyone's experience. The scale is simply too vast for easy explanation. They seem more symbolic than real."
He paused. "Yes," said Sanguinius. "Symbolism. That is a key, somehow. In the Cygnus system, that symbol of the eight-pointed star covered a planet, and there are patterns to the beings of the demons. They represent things."
"Then perhaps so did your victory," Cano suggested. "We can use their nature against them."
"As they do to us," Sanguinius thought. "A single blow can change the galaxy, then," he said. "Or a single choice. That came before the blow."
"For the better."
"In this case..." Sanguinius was not satisfied. Too much still flowed from his actions. He dreaded the constellation of circumstances that might grant him even more power.
"More reasons to be on guard,"
said Cano.
"Even so..."
He trailed off. Blood drained from his face. His eyes widened in sudden pain. The red tear jerked, a toy in the hand of a giant. The drop from the warp was as violent as it had been before the fortress. The sound pierced the hull in the next moment, high-pitched, vibrating, like a tuning fork struck against madness itself. Sanguinius supported Cano from the Sanctorum, fighting through the thrumming in his own skull. He felt warmth on his neck. Blood was running from his ears.
"Where are we?"
Gilliman called. He wiped the blood from his nose and ears. On the bridge below the pulpit, officers clutched their heads in agony. One man's teeth had chattered so violently they had splintered. Servitor movements were jerking, spasmodic, unpredictable. The resonance hammered through the hull. The Samothrace rang as if the vibrations would shake it to powder.
"Where are we?"
Gilliman repeated. The system was not Davin. Much more than that was ceasing to have meaning in this region of the galaxy. Gilliman called for the information to force purpose into the crew, to give them a way forwards through the pain of the unceasing resonance. The crew responded to the command in Gilliman's voice. More officers collapsed, but others found strength in duty. The cogitators were spitting out gibberish scrap data, and the Auspex array had to be shut down and restarted. At last, Nestor Lortenix spoke, his voice thick with pain.
"Epissimos,"
he said.
"It's Epissimos!"
"Thrinas again," said Prato.
The librarian had grasped the railing overlooking the bridge. His posture was straight, but only through a massive effort of will. As painful as the sound was for Gilliman, it was much more harmful for the psyker. Blood droplets had formed on Prato's forehead.
"There were refugees from here,"
he said.
"Yes,"
Gilliman said, sparing him further effort. He had made the connection too. Epissimos IV had been well represented in the camp on Thrinos. The evidence of the pilgrim's passing was obvious. Enormous constructs filled the system, dwarfing the worlds. The vessels of the fleets once again had to fight from being captured by the gravitational pull of the gigantic bodies. The objects were so immense, their shapes extended far beyond the limits of the Epissimos system, beyond the range of the scans. They might, Gilliman thought, reach as far as other systems. They might be light years in size. Objects, shapes, constructs. Gilliman hunted for words of greater precision, words that would describe the immensities he saw and give him a measure of control. The whining, spine-grinding sound made it hard for him to think, but even in silence language would have failed him. There were no names for these things. The demon fortress, at least, had been recognizable. Its obscenity had been in its size. The constructs in the Epissimus system were geometry run amok. Angles building on and into other angles. On the nearest mass, the side facing the Samothrace, was dominated by a formation that seemed to be both an extrusion and a depression. The pounding in Gilliman's head grew worse when he tried to force sense onto the formation, and he turned away.
"Analysis," he said, maintaining order on the bridge. "Warp," said Prato, breathing hard.
"Granted. But what is the materium correlative? The fortress was stone and brass. The abominations have something we can recognize as flesh. What is this?"
Gilliman spoke with more frustration than he intended. The surfaces appeared to be smooth. The objects were carved from single blocks millions and billions of miles on a side. Colors swam and rippled across them, deep, rotten violets and greens. Patterns like the scales of reptiles appeared and disappeared. The constructs had hides, or they were ice, or they were a dream. Lines curved and straightened, a language of monsters preaching its lessons to the materium. The meaning of the lesson crawled inside Gilliman's chest. He tore his eyes from the flowing runes before he could understand them and be wounded. He was not sure how many of the constructs there were in the system. A few floated alone in the void, serene in their lonely horror. Others were linked to one another, forming complexes so vast they extended beyond the range of the scanners. Even more than the fortress, these monoliths were the death of reason. There was no logic to the structures. Their material was the reification of madness. Their foundation was the bones of the Emperor's dream.
"What are they?" said Dracus Gorod.
His question had no expectation of an answer. It was an expression of frustrated anger. Gilliman gave him an answer all the same.
"They are the consequences of the loss of this war."
He wondered if Horus or Lorgar really understood what they had unleashed. Was this what they wanted? They could not rule here. There would be nothing to rule. They would be slaves of these powers.
"The sound," Prato said. "They are making it."
He pushed himself back from the railing, wiping blood from his face. He worked through the pain with grim determination. His psychic hood crackled as if he were fending off an attack.
"There are lines," he said.
He was speaking with difficulty.
"Psychic lines between the constructs and between them and the worlds."
He winced. More blood appeared on his brow.
"I can see it. It's a web."
His voice trailed off. There was a flare from his hood, and then he was steadier again.
"It's holding us here."
From below, one of the ship's tech priests, Byzanus, looked up.
"With respect, Librarian Prato," he said,
his bionic larynx hitching and popping with static.
"This seems unlikely. We cannot detect any source of energy from the constructs. They are inert."
"Their being is enough," said Prato.
"Their shapes, their positions. The web is created by their conjunctions."
"So we have no enemy to combat," said Gilliman.
"What is our status?" he asked Tiresia Althusser.
"Almost immobilized," said the shipmaster. "The warp drive is inert. We have some power in the engines, but not much. We can maneuver to a limited degree, but if we get much closer to any of those objects, I'm not sure we'll be able to resist their gravitation."
The back of Gilliman's skull throbbed with pain. If the mass, shape, and position of the constructs was creating the sound, then he had to disrupt those conditions. But the constructs were too large to destroy.
"My lord," said Terence, "vox activity coming from Epissimos 3.
"Human?"
"Yes."
Terence stabbed at the screen before her.
"It's broken up badly. They appear to be hailing the fleets."
"Take us closer," Gilliman ordered. He looked at the fleet positions. The Dark Angels were nearest to Epissimos 3. Contact the First Legion, he told Terence. I will speak to my brother. The vox traffic between the ships was rough. The lion's voice scratched in Gilliman's ear, but he could understand the other Primarch well enough. The Dark Angels had picked up the same transmission. At their location, closer to the source, it was clearer.
The Imperial forces planetside are under siege, the lion said.
I'm impressed they've held out this long, said Gilliman.
I believe their time is growing short. They're asking for liberation.
Epistemos III was a blackened skull. Its two great hives still burned, embers glowing in eye sockets. Further from the sun, Epistemos IV had been the cooler, more temperate heart of the system. Now its surface was a writhing mass of grey flesh. Thin lips pulled back over a continent-wide smile. Teeth showed, then vanished, and another parted, running across the fading scar of the first maw. The world had become hunger. Epistemos III, though, still fought. It still screamed.
We have made contact with a Colonel Aleska Rivas, the lion told Gilliman. We will relay the substance of our communications.
He had hesitated before making that commitment, then decided it would be better for his brothers to know what was being said. In this instance, he would want them to understand the reasons for the actions he sensed he would have to take.
Who is in command of your operations? The lion asked Rivas.
I am, she voxed back. Our Lord Governor is dead. General Pala dropped out of contact a week ago.
Her words were slurred with exhaustion and horror.
And your current situation?
He could foresee what the import of the answer would be. Liberate us. That was the cry that had first come through on the vox. If there had been any trace of hope in those hails to the fleet, it did not sound like the sudden expectation of victory. The lion had been careful to use the same word when he spoke to Gilliman. Liberation, not reinforcements. Sitting in the throne above the Invincible Reasons Bridge, he knew that he was, in this moment, a judge more than a military commander.
Our resistance is confined to isolated pockets.
Is there any chance of linking up?
No. Even if we could, it would be pointless.
Do not try my patience with defeatism, Colonel.
I'm not, my lord. I'm stating facts. Ever since the Pilgrim came...
Rivas trailed off, the horror in her voice growing so strong that it strangled her words.
It destroyed everything in orbit. We couldn't escape. Did anyone from Epistemos IV get away?
They did, the lion told her.
Oh, good.
She sighed with dark joy.
Then our culture will survive.
Perhaps, the lion thought. The refugees on Thrinos were cut off from the rest of the Imperium. Their long-term survival was doubtful.
What was the Pilgrim? The lion asked.
He had to, though he did not expect to get an answer any clearer than had been found on Thrinos. He was right.
We don't know,
said Rivas.
It came like a ship, but it was much too big. It brought the change.
Her breathing was ragged.
Nothing is real anymore, she whispered to herself.
Colonel!
The lion snapped, breaking into her thoughts before she disappeared into them, reminding her of her duty.
Yes, my lord, I'm sorry. My troops are holding a block of the Underhive. We might have a few more days. But there is nothing to break out to. The land is turning against us. We lost contact with the southern continent when it attacked the regiments there. These things... My lord, there are billions of them. They cover the land. And there is a disease, or a corruption. I don't know how to name it. Our people are changing. This needs to end while any of us are still human.
Are you clear about what you are asking? The lion said.
I am, my lord. Save our souls.
The lion frowned. Rivas was loyal to the Emperor, but in their extremity, she and her people were failing in their loyalty to the Imperial truth.
Exterminate the monsters, she said. Send us to the embrace of the Emperor.
The lion was silent for a moment. The endless whine sawed its way through his skull. Then he said,
"Very well. Make your preparations."
"Thank you, my lord."
He silenced the channel, then reopened communications with Gilliman and the Angel.
"I am ordering the use of cyclonic torpedoes on Epistemos III," he said.
"You said there were loyal forces still fighting there," said Gilliman.
"I did. This is the liberation they request."
"This is precipitous,"
Sanguinius protested. "We did not know definitely there was a key to breaking open the barrier of the fortress until we were inside the Manufactorum on Pyrrhon."
"The situation is different," said the lion. "There is no victory here. Epistemos III is overrun with demons. Nothing more. Or have you perceived something else, Sanguinius?"
"No,"
the angel admitted.
"No. There is nothing to save here."
"Except the loyal troops themselves."
"Nor them. They are falling away from our father's path. Their sacrifice is the last, best demonstration of loyalty they can still make. They know this. The planet is diseased. It must be purged."
"By that logic," said Gilliman, "we should destroy the entire system."
"I would if I could," said the lion. "I will shatter a world sooner than stand by and let it be corrupted. So, Epistemos III will die."
Neither Gilliman nor Sanguinius answered.
"Your silence is consent," the lion said. "Captain,"
he turned to Stennius,
"prepare cyclonic torpedoes for launch, full barrage. This world is corrupt to its core. Let only dust remain."
The command felt like a counterattack against the malevolent resonance. The invincible reason had maneuvered to place Epistemos III directly before it. The smouldering planet occupied the center of the oculus. At the edges of the lion's view, the corners of the great shapes intruded. He spared them a glare of hatred before he focused his attention on Epistemos III. They were foul mysteries, secrets that he could not pierce, and he knew better than to try. The depths of the unknown were a reminder of the risks he was incurring in the relationship he was forging with Tuchulcha. A reminder so pointed, it was an accusation.
"What would you have me do instead?"
he asked in a prosecutorial voice that sounded a lot like Gilliman's.
"Would you have us still lost on the edges of Ultramar?" "I will not. I will do what we must."
The torpedoes launched.
"Vox," he said, "contact Colonel Rivas again."
"But the channel is open," the Vox officer reported, "but she doesn't answer."
The lion listened to the noise flooding from the Vox speaker. There was static, the distant sounds of battle, screams, human and inhuman, a rising clamour of voices shouting a language that formed a chorus with the resonance.
"Close the link," the lion said.
"Farewell, Colonel," he thought.
He wished her the good fortune of hearing the torpedoes arrive. The first two torpedoes hit the besieged hives. The final bastions of Epistemos III disappeared in a blaze of light thousands of miles across. The guttering eyes shone with a flare of vengeance. The intensity of the blast faded then, but its spread kept growing. The atmosphere caught fire. The flame clouds reached around the globe like the peeling back of flesh to reveal the burning blood beneath. The second stage of the bombardment hit a planet that was already dying. The Invincible Reason was close enough that its Auspex array was able to filter most of the distortion caused by the resonance and register the process of the planetary crematorium. The initial torpedoes had split the crust. The wounds went deep, convulsing the mantle, triggering seismic upheavals that tore continents to shreds. In the southern hemisphere, the land screamed with the voice of a living thing. The second wave plunged through the wounds and hit the planet's core. The pressure wave of the blasts pushed outwards in every direction. It could not be contained. The surface of the planet was invisible under the flaming atmosphere, but the upheavals are so violent it vibrated before the lion's eyes. Arcs of magma rose thousands of miles. For a few seconds, the planet resembled a star. But the image was a lie. It was unsustainable. The pressure wave reached the surface, and Epistemos III exploded. The raging heat of its annihilation caught the fragments of crust as they were propelled into the void. They melted, collided, disintegrated. Before the shockwave of the planet's explosion buffeted the Dark Angel's fleet, the Lion's command had been executed. Nothing but dust remained. The mind-scraping whine scaled new, acute peaks in the moments of the world's final agony. The Lion winced, and blood started flowing from his ears again. But when the planet shattered, the sound stopped at once. The silence was startling. For the space of a heartbeat, the Lion thought he was deaf. He stood up from the throne.
"My lord," the Vox officer called, "hails from the Red Tier and the Samothrace."
"I'm sure there are," he thought. "I will tell you when I am ready to answer."
He strode from the bridge. There was something he had to do first. Someone else he had to speak with first. In the chamber of Tuchulcha, the servitor was waiting for him. It had degenerated noticeably since the arrival at Epissimos. The resonance had sunk into its flesh like rot. It had lashed at the body like a whip. Mottled skin hung from its legs. The musculature was spongy. The stench was thick. The Lion tasted its viscous quality at the back of his throat. The meat puppet's scalp was splitting. It oozed yellow and green pus. Its eyes were filmed, but the will of Tuchulcha focused them on the Lion as if they were laz sights. Blistered lips moved.
"Do you wish to travel again?"
Tuchulcha asked through its proxy.
"Can we?"
"We can. You did what was necessary."
So simple, the Lion thought. He caught himself. He must not trivialize the destruction of an entire world.
"We did not damage the constructs," he said.
The servitor shrugged.
"You altered the configuration of the system. The alteration is sufficient. They cannot hold me here now."
"And where will you take us this time? What nightmarish impossibility awaits us now?"
Tuchulcha did not respond to his sarcasm.
"Where do you wish to go?"
"Davin."
"As you will, it shall be done."
The old formulation again. The words Tuchulcha had last spoken when the Lion had thought to travel to Caliban. The Lion walked slowly back to the bridge. He was barely aware of Holguin's presence. He hadn't realized the Deathbringer had followed him to the entrance of the chamber. Holguin kept his peace until they were in the hall leading to the bridge.
"Is the way clear, then?"
he asked.
"Well, so it seems."
"How?"
"One of Gilliman's librarians believes it was the arrangement of shapes in the system that created the resonance. We removed a shape."
"That was..." Holguin stopped.
"Easy?" the Lion asked.
"I did not mean to suggest that."
"But you thought it."
Holguin nodded once, visibly uneasy.
"Our sense of scale has been affected," said the Lion. "Inevitably."
The hall through which they walked was high-ceilinged. Marble columns formed its vaults. Monumental statues commemorated the extermination of the beasts of Caliban. The light from the wall sconces could not pierce the dimensions of the hall, and deep shadows draped the walls. The architecture was designed for awe. The Lion felt the presence of the constructs pressing in, invisibly, through the hull. They made the hall insignificant. They made everything the Lion knew insignificant. Yet he had defeated the trap. The fleets were about to leave the demonic constructs behind. It did not matter how vast they were. They were the things that had lost their significance, and the Lion had taken it from them.
"There is a lesson here."
"What lesson, my lord?"
Holguin asked. The Lion shook his head. He hadn't meant to speak aloud.
"Oh, ignore my incomplete thoughts," he said.
Only they were more complete than he admitted. The destruction of a world had punched a hole through an immaterial net. The Lion wondered how far he could extend the principle. The vision was tempting in its simplicity. Horus and the rest of the traitors could not rule if they had no bases. The Lion pictured a program of deliberate systematic annihilation. If a world had fallen to the enemy, a campaign to take it back was a waste of resources. "Break the worlds and break the foe," he thought. The Lion suppressed a smile as he and Holguin entered the bridge again. How do you like this theoretical rebuti? He thought. He would shortly have the opportunity to put it to a practical test. He sat in the throne once more. He looked through the oculus at the debris field that had been Epissimos III. He nodded to the Vox officer who opened channels to Gilliman and Sanguinius.
Brothers, said the lion, our path forwards is clear. Let us take it.